So thank you for accommodating me, and it's really nice to be here. And it's fun to be able to talk to these various groups, since this work will be from different perspectives, it involves various ways of approaching the problem. So so what this talk will be about is, last summer, 17 years ago, people were wondering in string theory how to accommodate the discovery of dark energy or whatever it is. And it's an important question. How can you get a perturbative realization of de Sitter space in string theory? Now, of course, that's challenging, primarily because the basic tools string theorists have at their disposal to get perturbative answers is supersymmetry, and as we all know, supersymmetry doesn't allow positive energy. So the question is, it might be that there's some non-perturbative solution that no one will ever find, but it'd be, of course, very nice if we could find a perturbative realization of de Sitter space. And there was a very clever way of going about it that was done by Kakru, Kalish, Linde, and Trivedi. And it seemed complicated, to be honest, but it seemed like the kind of thing that if a model builder had written down, it would have been laughed at a little bit. It was that level of complication. But since it was the only way to realize it, people paid a lot of attention and came up with lots of ideas based upon this, such as the discretum and different ways of accommodating the positive energy that's seen based on discrete fluxes. Now, there were certainly some issues in many different cases that people had, and I'll refer to some of them that people had, but a lot of them had to do with whether or not you could trust just using an effective theory when there was no fundamental realization of the theory. And I'll talk about that a little bit. But what I realized last summer was that it was less, that a lot of the issues were even less settled than I had thought. So I just wanted to find out what was going on. So basically, I hadn't really worked on this. I came back to this last summer, and so had a back and forth trying to understand what's going on. And so it's definitely true that part of the problem, it's hard to tell whether or not this theory is completely correct, is because there are different pieces to it. And it's really hard to just, I mean, ideally, you know, the ideal world of a string theorist, and actually most physicists, you just write down the theory and then you just work it out. But this theory is so complicated that no one can actually do that. So so in some sense, there's many moving parts, so no one has the full Lagrangian. But the point is that they made, which is a very good point, which is that you don't have to work out the whole theory if you trust effective theory. If you could just write down the 4D effective theory, then you're done and you can see this works. Now, the problem that seemed to me, I mean, there were a number of problems that I was told about last summer and read about, but really the problem seemed to be to me that every time someone tried to write down a higher dimensional theory, it just didn't work. Now, usually it was some back and forth, someone would write it down, there'd be a singularity, people would say there's a reason the singularity isn't valid, but it just wasn't coming up with the right answer. And so that doesn't mean it wasn't right, because it always, of necessity, there were approximations. But essentially, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire sometimes, and so it just, I was curious why we were having so much trouble coming up with the right answer. So I didn't actually have either, I didn't have a belief that one way or the other, I just wanted to understand what was going on. So I'm going to take a pretty agnostic point of view during most of this, and I'll try to explain that. So I just wanted to know whether de Sitter space exists as a perturbative state of string theory.
What do you mean perturbative?
I just mean something that we can actually work out. And you could say that things can happen in a strongly coupled regime, and then you can't actually calculate anything. So
weak non-perturbative effects are okay, like instantons and stuff?
Instantons are okay, yeah. So, thank you. That's true. I mean, so as long as it's something that allows for calculation, I'm calling it perturbative. Yeah, so I should probably say controlled rather than perturbative. You're right. Yeah. But it seems to me that, you know, so a lot of string theorists have moved on. They don't care about this question. Of course, many of the people here do care a lot about this question. But it seems to me it's a kind of important question. You know, can we realize the vacuum that we know is part of our world in string theory? And is there at least one example? I mean, you know, you read in the newspaper that there's 10 to the 500 examples. I want you to know, is there actually one example that we can trust? Okay? So what I'm going to try to explain why, at least based on this work, and some of the work that some people here have done, I think that in principle, I don't see a reason in principle it wouldn't work, although some of the swampland people will argue that some of the fluxes that are needed might not be possible. But in principle, it should work. But I would say, I'm going to argue that based on existing models that we know about, there really is no explicit example. The fluxes that we know about just in theories where we've really stabilized everything will not be enough to actually get a controlled example where it works. That's what I will argue. And why is what I'm coming up with so orthogonal or at least different from what the other two groups did? So basically, as I said, there's sort of 10D people and there's sort of 4D people. And I'm a kind of a 5D person. So I wanted to see from a 5D point of view what was going on. And one of the reasons I like the 5D point of view is, unlike the 10D point of view, you can write down the complete theory. And unlike the 4D point of view, you can have some of the places where some of the things can occur. And the basic point is that it's fine to write down an effective theory, but you have to have an effective theory of some stable vacuum. So, and the only way to really check for stability in general is either to make sure you have all the fields in your low energy theory or to go to the higher dimensional theory. So what I'm going to argue is that there's a field that is relevant, which has been left out, which is the radion. And by radion, I don't mean the radion of a Clavier. I mean the radion that establishes the length of a warped five-dimensional geometry throw. Okay? So I'm going to argue that that field is, in fact, light, that when people froze all the moduli fields and froze them, that they left out the fact that warping can make some of the fields lighter, and this is a rather irrelevant field. And I'm going to show, so when I did this, I was just wondering what was going on. Of course, to actually know whether or not it's going to work, you really need the details of the model. Unfortunately, the people listed here, many of whom are present, I guess, or some of whom are present, showed implicitly, I'm going to argue, what the radion was. They didn't call it the radion, but it turns out that there will be a condition on the fluxes that you need to have basically the flux through one of the cycles bigger than about 7, root GS times M bigger than about 7. And I'm going to show that based on the fluxes of existing theories where things have been completely worked out, that's quite a big number, actually. You might have thought that this could, I'll talk about what I mean by these various fluxes, but there's going to be some warp geometry where we start off with fluxes of K times M, and it's going to break down to M. And so both K has to be a large number. M didn't necessarily have to be that large.
Is that squared GSM greater than 7? Is that what that is?
I said there's an instability unless GSM is greater than 7. Sorry, there's an instability when it's small.
That is incorrect.
I'm glad you're all paying attention. Thank you very much. I deliberately did that. Speaking for the group. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to do effective 5D theory and identify what that instability is in my language. Okay. And I think it's a nice way of looking at it because I think it makes it clear what's going on. And so there'll be a destabilization for too small GSM squared. And what that instability is going to be a runaway of the IR brain, which from the point of view of the original construction is sort of the conifold deformation. So the conifold is going to basically run off to infinite length. So that's going to be interesting because that was something that was thought to be fixed. But I'm going to argue that if you add energy at the end of the conifold, it actually destabilizes the conifold so that it would run off to infinity. Okay. And the one confusion that's occurred in the literature because the radion wasn't explicitly included is sometimes people sort of had hints of this kind of instability, but it was associated with the volume modulus. And I'm going to argue that there's a volume modulus, which is light, but there's also this radion, which is also fairly light. And I think the instability is really associated with that. Okay? So it's metastable, not just in the volume modulus direction, but also in the radion direction, is what I'm going to argue. Okay. So there's going to be a number of different ingredients. There's like many moving parts in my talk as well. But I'm going to start first with something that's a little bit orthogonal, but I found kind of cute and sort of nicely leads to the desiderate construction that we're going to see. So this is some work that I did with David Pinner, where we just were looking to see, like, why is it so hard to get desiderate space with compact dimensions? So I'm just going to, I mean, this is really stuff that's known to a lot of people. Basically, one paper we're ruling it out in general rules it out. But it's kind of interesting because even if you don't have string theory and even if you don't have supergravity, it's actually just very hard to write down, or at least it's complicated, to write down a model where you have compact dimensions in desiderate space. And I'll just show that based on energy momentum tensors. Okay, so that's just by way of it's a little bit of an aside, but then, but one of the interesting results of that is going to be that one of the simplest ways to get deserted space is going to turn out to be in a warp geometry, where you really secretly have anti-deserted space, but you have boundary conditions that establish a slicing this deserted space, and I'll explain that. I'm going to introduce KKLT, which is a way of obviously finding what I'm calling perturbative, but really should have been calculable, manageable loophole. Study KKLT as a toy, but I'm going to actually do a 5D version of the theory that I'm going to claim it incorporates some essential ingredients. And to do that, I'm also going to have to review a couple of things about 5D geometry that not everyone will necessarily know. That includes sort of bent brains, which is to say geometries that are sliced not with Minkowski space, but with curved space, like ADS or de Sitter. And I'm also going to review the Goldberger-Wise mechanism for stabilizing two brains, because that's going to play an essential role. And that's going to involve a relatively heavy, what's called Goldberger-Wise field, and also a relatively light radion. And the Goldberger-Wise field is actually one of the structure moduli. And those of you who paid attention to this know that not everything from the end of the throat decoupled is 1/r^4. There was actually something that was logarithmic, and I'm going to claim that's the Goldberger-Wise field. Actually, I'm claiming it right now. Okay. And I'm going to show how the radion and the Goldberger-Wise field resolves at least one issue I had with the uplift. I was just confused about why something would work. And that's basically just the fact that you're given two different boundary conditions. The uplift, as we're going to see, we're going to have this geometry. It's going to be a five-dimensional geometry. There's going to be a Calabi-Yau at one end, a conifold, a deformation at the other end. But the point is that one end is going to have negative energy. The other end is going to have this positive energy that's added. So naively, it would be an inconsistent geometry. Now, no one really thinks it's an inconsistent geometry. But to make it a consistent geometry, you obviously have to have some back reaction. And what was confusing was that I kept being told that in the Prober approximation, we could ignore all the moduli fields, and then it's fine. But what I'm going to argue is that you can't ignore the back reaction, or else you're going to get an inconsistent geometry. And I think this is helpful for people who are trying to write down 10-dimensional versions of this theory with all the heavy fields integrated, all the heavy moduli fields integrated out. Because if you really integrate them all out, you'll never get this back reaction, and you will necessarily get inconsistencies, which might show up as singularities. Yeah.
You just said the word back correction can be confusing. So I wanted to know, do you think of it as back correction on moduli, which some people tend to call 4D back correction? Or do you think of it as 6D back correction, which many people mean how things are evolving inside the extra dimensions?
Okay.
Like, for instance, a back correction of a brain is often called 6D back correction, whereas a back correction on the volume modulus would be 4D back correction.
So it's kind of confusing because the whole construction is based on, you have a Calabi-Yau, but then as you know, you're going to add brains and have a throat. So it's no longer really factorizing into six-dimensional. It's really five-ish dimensional with an extra dimension. So the back correction that I'm talking about is on this extended version of the throat. So in some sense, it is part of the structure moduli of the Calabi-Yau, but it's been distorted so much that it doesn't look like that anymore. So what it's going to do, so if I just draw a picture, just because it's useful to have for the rest of it. So if I think of having a Calabi-Yau, don't worry, I'm not drawing anything so detailed people can't see it. Okay, if we have a Calabi-Yau and then we put some brains and then we have a throat coming off this. Okay, so now it's no longer a Calabi-Yau, it's sort of some geometry where it's not factorizable. So what I'm going to be talking about is a back reaction that's going to have to do with how the energy redistributes within this region to get a consistent geometry. Okay, so you can call those whatever you want. Okay, but that's something no one has. I mean, so it's neither of the things you were talking about. No one had actually been paying attention to that. Okay. All right. So that's what I'm going to be. That's going to be the first thing that's going to interest me, and this is why it became clear that this is going to have to do with something about the stabilization mechanism here, because that's the only way to redistribute the energy. Basically, if you have some stable thing and you add something, if you had a spring and you added some energy at the end, the spring's going to have to adjust to make it stable, or else the spring is going to break. And that's essentially what's going to happen here. Okay? And so this was actually identified by the authors I said earlier as what they called conifold destabilization. So I think by now there's been so many papers that say it doesn't work, and then papers that say it do work, that this very nice paper, I think, sort of went noticed by some communities, but sort of not noticed by others. But I think I'm going to argue that this destabilization that was found there is real, and it actually corresponds to this radian, becoming destabilized. So if M is too small, okay? And if we have time, I'm going to like just accept the construction for what it is and just talk about some interesting supersymmetry breaking implications, but I don't know if I'll have time for that or not. Okay, so that's the outline. Any questions at this point? Okay. So the first point is just some simple, this is just some simple follow your nose exercises, but I found it kind of enlightening. I don't know if you will, but I found it enlightening, which is, you know, why is it so hard just to construct a pseudo space with some compact dimensions? It's just, if you solve Einstein's equations, it just doesn't want to give you a De Sitter space. And this, again, it has nothing to do with string theory, it has nothing to do with supergravity. And here I'm going to be making very simple assumptions. So there's other ways that you can have very complicated dependencies of intermingling of the different dimensions. But for now, I'm just going to actually factorize and just assume I have some compact dimensions and then have De Sitter space. Okay, so that's the first case. So the question is, you know, so just work backwards. So we're just working backwards. Yes. What is the energy momentum tensor you would need in order to get this? Seems straightforward exercise. And if you do it, you find that, so even if I set those H dot terms to zero, you see there's ones in the first four components, and then there's two in the other components. So there's basically not an energy, it's not simple to write down an energy momentum tensor that can give you this. I mean, because it looks like, you know, we have to treat the time, you know, if you have something that's just spatial, it's fine, but if you have something that really respects the symmetries we know about, it involves a time component too, and it's very hard to get that. So how can you try to get it? Well, you can try to add together a cosmological constant and then have some other term which is purely spatial. Now, that's kind of weird, but the problem is that when you add the other thing, it turns out it has to be negative energy. So that would be fine if you have some negative tension object that's at an orbital fixed point, for example. But if you really want to do the higher dimensional construction, you sort of want this gas of negative tension objects, and that would be totally unstable. So from an effective theory point of view, it would be fine. You can imagine having one negative tension object at a fixed point and then averaging over the space. But if you just actually tried to write down the higher dimensional version, this isn't going to work. So let's try something else. So let's include curvature in the extra dimension. So again, let's just do some dumb example. So we just do S4 times S2. Okay. And so you do that. And then it looks like, okay, you can make it work. So if you take the right value of H squared R squared, you get it to work. Now, of course, this is, again, a very simple example. But that's unstable. So this doesn't work. Okay? So none of the simple things work. Okay? So let's try something warped, make it a little bit more complicated. So let's just have some extra fifth dimension and have the other components depend on that coordinate so that we have some possibility of finding a solution. And you find that it's not as general as you might think. H of y has to be a constant. The coefficient of the time has to be related to the coefficient of the space. And you then find some other interesting conditions. Okay, so you want to get rid of all your off-diagonal components. And when you do that, you find this kind of weird thing, which is that when you solve it, you find that f of y has the following form here. Okay, this is written in a really weird way. But basically, it's the sum of a positive exponential. It's actually the difference, rather, of a positive exponential and a negative exponential, which obviously can be written as a cinch. And whereas we're going to talk about later, when we talk about bent brains, that means what you really have is a De Sitter slicing of ADS space, okay? So what you really have, so ADS space can be sliced in different ways. It can be sliced as Minkowski, it can be sliced as De Sitter, it can be sliced as anti-De Sitter. Which one it's going to be depends on your boundary conditions. So I haven't told you boundary conditions yet, but what this is telling you is that probably the most straightforward way to get De Sitter space is to actually not really have De Sitter space. It's really to have anti-De Sitter space and somehow break the symmetry in a way that your boundary conditions are De Sitter. Once your boundary conditions are De Sitter, then you can have De Sitter space throughout from a 4D perspective. So you're getting around this by not really having De Sitter space. You really have anti-De Sitter space. Breaking the symmetry with the boundary conditions. And in fact, that's going to play a role in KKLT, so it's not just accidental that I'm mentioning this. So it's kind of interesting. So that's probably the easiest way to get anti-De Sitter. Now, to be fair, if you have other dimensions, I'm not going to go through this, but if you have other dimensions, you end up with having, if you make these simple factorizable assumptions, it looks like you'd have negative curvature. So even then, if you have extra dimensions, that is to say, if you have 10 dimensions, you're going to have something more complicated. But it does look like this is probably the best route. Okay. So the lesson of this exercise is that perhaps the warp solution might be the most natural way to get to sitter from higher dimensions. So you don't directly go to de sitter, you really go to anti-de sitter, and then slice it with de sitter space. And then, of course, once you have the de sitter slicing, SUSY is broken, but at least it tells you a sort of more controllable way that you might try to get this. And again, the slicing is determined by boundary conditions, and we're in KKLT, we're going to see supersymmetry breaking by having something at the end. So it, again, it's a boundary condition. And that's kind of what lets you get some controllable solution. Okay?
Sorry. So in this setup, the propagators look like an ADS, or an ADS?
Well, from the five-dimensional point of view, they're ADS. And if you did a four-dimensional effective theory, they would look like the sitter. And in general, as you know, your propagators are determined also by your boundary condition. You know, you have to be careful about the boundary condition. So you have a propagator in the bulk of the space, it would just be ADS. And it wouldn't, if it doesn't know the boundary condition, it doesn't know which way it's being sliced. It's only when you get to the boundaries that you actually know. I mean, it's one of the really interesting things about anti-de-sitter space. Okay, other question?
Yeah? What about Casimir energy? That can have a funny-looking energy moment condenser like the one you showed as well.
Yeah, so again, we actually went through all these different cases. You can do that, but again, as far as I don't know how to do Casimir energy as a higher dimensional thing. I could do it as an effective theory. So, you know, if the name of the game was to write down a higher dimensional thing that gives you distributed space, I just don't know how to do it. So it's not to say that it wouldn't necessarily work. You could actually, but it turns out, actually, even with Casimir energies, it turns out, is just true that you have to balance three different terms. So you basically can balance three falling exponentials and get it to work. So that's possible. So it's fine, but first of all, it's probably non-perturbative, really non. And second, I don't know how to write down the higher dimensional theory, but it is a possibility. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I'm going to go back to the main thing that we want to do, which is KKLT. Okay. How did they construct de sitter? So I'm assuming most of you are fairly familiar with this, so I'm going to give a very brief review. If there's any questions, just interrupt. Okay, so basically you're starting off with a 10-dimensional. I'm not going to worry about F theory. I'm just going to call it 10-dimensional Clouty Alpha. Okay, and the interesting thing is that there are fluxes, and the fluxes stabilize all the complex structure moduli. Okay, except the only problem is that there's necessarily going to be one modulus that's left unfixed. And that's the volume modulus, okay? So and that's basically because of a no-scale structure in the theory. I'm not going to go through any of the details, but there's no-scale structure. So you have to break this no-scale structure, and they do it by having some non-perturbative effect, which could be a gauge unicorn set, it could be an instanton. But the point is there's an exponential, okay? So rather than just have the superpotential be W0 from fluxes, there's an additional term which has this exponential A sigma. So sigma here is the volume modulus. It's sometimes called sigma. It's sometimes called rho. It's like rho. Sigma is like the imaginary part of rho, or vice versa. I don't remember which, but it doesn't matter. Okay, I think sigma is the imaginary part of rho. Okay, but the point is that W0 is assumed small, and I put a star there because there's lots of places people get upset about this theory. One of them is, can you actually realize this small having W0 be small? I'm just to anticipate. I am going to allow for every assumption that KKLT wants to make. So I'm not going to question any of these. They might be questionable. There might be other places things break down. But I'm just going to accept that you can have small W0. And so the nice thing about that is if W0 is small, that means that you will minimize it when A sigma is big. So if it was like a gauge unicorn set, A might be something like 1 over N for an SUN gauge group or something like that, or 1 over 3N. Okay. But the point is if A sigma is big, then sigma is big, because A is generally less than 1. So that means you're minimizing it at large volume. And it's nice to minimize at large volume, because that makes it relatively stable against perturbations, against higher order corrections. Because essentially, the reason this is so nice is because, in a nutshell, if I take the derivative of expected sigma of the exponential, I get an A in front. If I take the derivative of sigma of 1 over sigma cubed, I get a 1 over sigma. And if A sigma is big, I can ignore the 1 over sigma term compared to the A term. That's in a nutshell why it's nice to have large volume. Okay? You're not going to disturb it that much. Okay. But you notice that when you minimize this, you have a negative energy, so you have ADS4. Okay? So you no longer have Minkowski space, you now have a negative energy. Okay. So sigma is large, you have negative energy. Okay. And it's relatively stable. Okay? So that's the first step. Now clearly that's not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is de Sitter space, but we have solved something which is very nice, which is to stabilize the volume modulus, which is nice independently of what we're looking for, because you have now a Clausius with everything stabilized. Okay. But to get positive energy, you need an uplift. Okay, so the next step is to add Suzy braking positive energy via antibranes. Okay. Now, if you just had antibranes and nothing else, your energy would be too big. Okay, because you have this suppressed energy, that energy is set by W0. So there's a negative energy set by W0. If you added string scale energy, that obviously would be too big, and you'd have way too big a positive de Sitter constant. You're looking for a very small de Sitter constant set by H0. Okay, so the energy would be density would be too big. So the way around that is to have a warp throat, and that's where the warp throat comes in. Okay, so the warp throat comes in because we're going to add the antibranes. They're going to be sent to the end of the throat, and so they are not going to have their naive energy, but they're going to have a warped down energy, which is set by the length of the throat. Okay, so there's going to be some naive antibrain tension. It's set by the length of the throat, and then it's a warm cyclic keystone as well. Okay. Okay. And again, notice that the sigma dependence here is not in the exponent. It's only in the denominator. And that actually confused me for a while, and I can come back to that if people are interested. But it's definitely the only in the denominator. Okay. So the next step is to just assume that I can tune the fluxes so that the length of the throat is just right to essentially cancel the energy that I had from the ADS space. Okay. So that's the next step, to just assume that they're tuned so they almost cancel. Now, you might wonder whether that's possible. That's probably possible given the number of fluxes. This is another place where people get upset, though, because until you do this, you don't really have to worry. It turns out that if you were thinking cosmologically, you probably would get the antibrain, the throat and the antibrain before you had the volume modulus stabilized. So there's some cosmological or, if you like, time dependence questions. Again, I'm going to assume this works. I'm assuming it just all happens at once. But if you were really following it in time, you might get worried, okay? And so from the 4D probe approximation point of view, this low energy theory is de Sitter. It just works, right? You have low energy, you have a positive cosmological constant, it's great, okay? The question is whether you trust this, okay? Questions? Okay. And I just want to just basically review the warp geometry. I'm not going to use it a whole lot, but again, the cartoon is that this is not just any old throat, this is a Klebanov-Strassler throat, so it's not really a pure ADS place. It's really, you can think of it as sort of a running N for like an SUN group. So you have N ultraviolet is MK, then you're going to keep breaking down the symmetry until you have M units of flux in the bottom of the throat. So you start off with MK, then you have M, okay? And the hierarchy, and this will be important later, comes from e to the minus 2 pi K over MGS, okay? So you can think of it as a running N, if you like, and that's the, but it is, it's ADS all the way, but it's ADS with increasing curvature, okay? And it's gonna crack off at a critical length, okay? And so you can think of the conifold deformation region as sort of the IR brain. So if you wanna think of this like an RS geometry, the Calabi-Yau is acting like the UV, here it's acting like the IR. And I don't just mean that as a statement, it's actually really important. Because when we write down this geometry, it's important that your matching conditions are right. So if I tell you that I have a particular geometry, it means that I better have the energy here matching in the correct way. And when we talk about Brent brains, I'll be a little more focused on what that means. But I just want to point out, the original paper just had 4D Minkowski space as the geometry, warp geometry, okay? And so these are the pictures from the original KKLT paper. That's just showing you have a minimum, and then this is the minimum with an uplift. And so that's after I add the d over sigma cubed. And the important point is that the minimum didn't change a lot because a sigma was big. Okay. All right. So one issue that bothered me, maybe it didn't bother anyone else, but it just confused me because here you have the negative energy here and the positive energy here. Now, if you want to consistently slice the geometry when you have ADS, and I'll do the review of bent brains in a moment, essentially the geometry is determined by the boundary condition in the UV. The UV is going to determine your geometry, and then you consistently slice it. And by slice it, I mean that you can have ADS projections in the five-dimensional space in four dimensions, and it could be different geometries. And what that geometry is determined by the matching condition. That matching condition is determined by the relationship between the ADS curvature scale and whatever your boundary condition tension is, okay? So there's going to be some relationship, so you're going to set it here. So you start. So the first construction, you said it's ADS. We said that's fine. You have an ADS space, that's fine. But that means that whatever matching you have here corresponds to the energy on your collabial corresponding to ADS space, okay? That means it's an undercritical region, okay? It's undercritical, is less energy than it would take to get Minkowski space. Yet at the end of the day, I'm telling you that I want to have a geometry that looks like De Sitter space because I've added energy here. Now, of course, if I just average it all out, it looks fine. But what that means is that somehow the energy I added here has to get to the UV. I've added in the IR, but it can't just sit in the IR. It has to go to the UV so that the boundary condition there corresponds to De Sitter space, okay? So how does that happen, okay? So again, from the 4D point of view, everything looks fine. But from the higher dimensional point of view, there's this confusing aspect of I've added energy here, and it has to be there in order to get a consistent energy throughout the space. Okay? Is that question clear to everyone? Yes? Okay. Okay. I think there's more. So clearly, you have to have some back reaction. So what's going to be the answer? Well, the answer is going to be associated with whatever created the stable geometry in the first place. Now, if I just considered this as rigid, then of course that's not going to happen, okay? And the energy would just sit here. You have to put in some field associated with this region, or else you're never going to see the back reaction. You need some field that can transfer the energy from here to here, okay? And that field, I'm going to claim, is basically one of the structure moduli field that we were sort of ignoring. Moreover, the way that's going to happen is there's going to be a light field that sits at the end of this throat. How does it happen that it moves? Well, it happens the same way it does in RS geometry, which is that there's a radion field that determines the length of this throat. And basically what happens is the throat will adjust slightly in response to the energy, assuming it's stable. Okay? So the length of this throat will adjust in just such a way that the matching condition is going to change to allow for De Sitter. So essentially, it's changing the gradient energy in a way that you're essentially adding energy to the region that you need. So remember I said energy has to be transferred. By pulling or by having this get bigger or smaller, there's a possibility that then you've changed the matching condition here. And of course, this matching condition has to be changed consistently so that when I pull it here, it has to give you exactly the right amount of energy there. So this is actually one of the beauties of the original Goldberg or Weiss construction that did this stability. They never actually showed this. But if you do, if it really is stabilizing the system, it has to do that automatically, okay? And I'll show you a little bit how that works, okay? And also note that one of the reasons the radion field was ignored, which is a field, is that basically it was sort of forgotten that all. So usually when you have Kaluza-Klein modes, usually your Kaluza-Klein. By usually I mean like if you have basically unwarped space. Your Kaluza-Klein modes are heavier than your zero mode, okay? So usually, you know, so you're all familiar with having M plus something like 1 over N or some where 1 of R, where R is the size of space. In the case of warp geometry, it's really interesting because your Kaluza-Klein modes can be much lighter than your zero mode, okay? So even though all the structure moduli are heavy, if you have a warp geometry, you have a whole bunch of light modes that live throughout the space, in particular at the end of the space. So when I talk about Kaluza-Klein modes, sometimes the original authors were referring to Kaluza-Klein modes of the collabial, but here I'm talking about Kaluza-Klein modes associated with the warp geometry, which can be quite light, okay? And I think that was the reason they were ignored, because there's Kaluza-Klein modes here that are light, okay, associated with the warp geometry, okay? And in particular, radium. Okay, so I've kind of said this, but I do want to emphasize that I'm going to just make all the KKLC assumptions. And I'm just going to construct a 5D theory that has all the features that they're assuming. And I'm just going to show there's still a potential instability. Okay? Okay. So why do I say the 5D effective theory has all the ingredients? Well, let's think about what a 5D... So I'm going to make a gross approximation and say this collabial is nothing other than just a boundary brain in the UV. The conifold is going to be nothing other than just a boundary brain in the IR. Okay, so it's a really gross approximation. Nonetheless, we have warping. I mean, it comes from the running end that I talked about earlier. And associated with that is a hierarchy. e to the minus 2 pi k over mgs, which is what allows the antibrain to have the warp down geometry, sorry, the warp down tension. The Clavielle space essentially serves as an ultraviolet ADS boundary. The conifold deformation region and space on the IR boundary, you might not easily think it's a de Sitter boundary because it has positive energy, but actually in RS constructions for consistent construction, you have positive energy. If you have positive energy on the UV brain, you have to have negative energy on the IR. So it's actually the conifold is secretly an IR brain that has negative energy. So when you add the positive energy, you're making actually a different de Sitter value. But it's nonetheless, you can, if it makes you happy, just think of it as ADS and de Sitter. But it's not really de Sitter. It's really just a different ADS. Okay. And unlike the 10-day theory, though, it has all the right ingredients, but you can construct the full model, and you can actually see the stabilization mechanism at work. And once you see that, then you'll know what's been left out of the 10-day theory to try to get a consistent theory. Okay. So because we're doing the 5-day theory, I'm just going to review briefly a couple of the ingredients that enter, namely the bent brains, determine the geometry, and the Goldberger-Wise stabilization mechanism, which I'm not sure everyone is familiar with. Okay. So bent brains, a number of people worked on this. I did it with Andreas Karch. And so this is taken from our paper, but that doesn't mean there aren't other references. Okay. So what you have is a Lagrangian which has a 5D part, so you have a 5D cosmological constant, and then you have a boundary brain, and that boundary brain is going to have some tension associated with it. Okay, so there's going to be some cosmological constant on the brain, and that's that delta R piece. And of course, if you have different boundaries, you'll have different brains. Okay. Now, we're going to assume that there is some warp geometry that solves this, and what you find is that the warp geometry is going to be either Minkowski, de Sitter, or anti-de Sitter, depending on the relationship between the tension that you have between that value lambda and between lambda and lambda, sorry, little lambda and capital lambda. That's what's going to determine it. So you can be undercritical, overcritical, or critical. And so the original constructions were all done for critical energy, so you just had Minkowski. But if you have energy that's less, it's going to be you would end up having boundary conditions that are anti-de Sitter, and I mean anti-de Sitter 4. And so you'd be taking the anti-de Sitter slicing of anti-de Sitter 5. If you have greater energy, you'd be taking the de Sitter slicing. Okay? So that's what determines it. So in the bulk, you can't tell the difference. It's all anti-de Sitter. You can slice it anywhere you want. But then at the end of the day, to get a consistent geometry, it's going to be determined by your boundary conditions. Okay? But of course, those two boundary conditions also have to be consistent. Okay. Okay, and I just want to point out, and string theorists in the audience can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's really interesting, because if you look at the original paper, there's sort of two pieces, and basically, there's a DBI action, and there you really know the charge, but then there's an energy piece. Now, if it's BPS, as they assumed, that energy piece is related to the charge, so they knew exactly what the RAP7 brain tension would be. And for that exact value of the RAP7 brain tension, you get the Minkowski boundary condition. So what's interesting is that if you're no longer BPS, you have the freedom for that RAP7 brain to have different energies, which is, I believe, how you can make it match. So although I don't know if anyone explicitly did it, when you have anti-de Sitter, you're going to have a different energy, and presumably that means the boundary condition from that RAP7 brain will be different in that case. Okay. So in the string theory construction, it's interesting that the part that is fixed, that's actually determined by a topological quantity, is not the energy, because that would have to adjust in order to get the right boundary condition. And the only reason that they knew what that energy was in the first place was because they assumed BPS. But once you deviate from that, then you would actually have to calculate it, but presumably it's going to work out to give you something consistent. So again, I'm not going to question that. I'm going to say that we know that that boundary condition can be made consistent. The only thing I wanted to see was how, if you make all the assumptions, the IR boundary would also be consistent once you add this energy, and that UV boundary adjusts, okay? So we're gonna have, so again, the original solution had the UV boundary be Minkowski, okay? The original stage of the construction would have the UV boundary be ADS, but after you add the energy in the IR, somehow that energy has to become, somehow that mismatch that determines whether what that boundary condition is has to turn it into de Sitter space, okay? So here's where the Goldberger-Wise field and the radion come in. So again, this is just a brief review. So the original way they did the construction, Goldberger and Wise did the construction, was they said, so when Raman and I wrote down our warp geometry, we knew that we were missing something because we hadn't stabilized the geometry. So although we could say there's an exponential hierarchy, we didn't know whether when you get stabilized, is it going to be stabilized at an exponential value or is it going to be stabilized at some modest value. So the interesting thing about the Goldberger-Wise solution is it showed how to stabilize it at some modest value so that the whole thing works out. And what they said is, and we'll talk about the dual interpretation momentarily, but what they said is simply, imagine you had a scalar field in the bulk. Okay? So you have a scalar field in the bulk that has some mass. If it has some mass, it doesn't want the geometry to be big because that would increase the energy. But they also take different values for the field on the two different boundary brains so that there's some gradient energy. Okay? So the gradient energy wants to spread the two brains apart. The mass or the potential energy wants to make the brains come together, so there's going to be some stabilization. And the nice thing is that that stabilization is at some modest value that allows for an exponential hierarchy. So even though KR can be some modest number of order 30, the ratio of where the brains are can be quite different, okay? And so, and here you just see that you can work it out. And one of the assumptions that's made is that the mass is small, that's determined by the parameter epsilon, so that there's not a huge back reaction, so the potential isn't huge, okay? So M over K is assumed to be small. And you can see, and one of the things that's interesting about the solutions that you see here is that you have one term that goes like e to the minus epsilon r, and another term, it depends on the sign of epsilon, or e to the 4 plus epsilon r. So essentially what you have is a term that's falling off from the UV, and you have another term that's coming into, that's falling in from the IR, okay? And so that was the leading order solution, but then in response to a perturbation, there can be a further shift. And so what happens is you can solve it, you get that simple log V or H over VV, but then when you have a perturbation, that R is going to adjust. And that's what I was talking about earlier. That radion field is going to adjust. And again, I don't have time to work through everything, and there was a nice literature on all of this, but the radion essentially lives in the IR region of the throat. Okay, so the radion is localized, although it's determining the total size of the space, its wave function is peaked in the IR. Okay, so it's a light field that lives in the IR region and can respond to a perturbation if I add energy there. And that's what allows the new so-called jump condition to be satisfied. When I add energy in the IR, it's what allows things to adjust. Okay. But the thing is that's nice is because notice that these coefficients, A and B of the solution, depend on R. So even though it looks like I'm just adjusting things in the IR, I'm adjusting R to make things work, it's also going to change what the value of phi is, not the value, but the derivative of phi is in the UV. So when I include that contribution to the bulk energy, I can in principle change from going from anti-de-Sitter to de-Sitter, depending on how that energy adjusts. Okay? So I'm going to have a new contribution to the energy that comes from the phi field that allows the new boundary conditions to be satisfied. And that's how the whole thing's going to work itself out. If this phi field is going to adjust, I'm going to adjust R, and it's going to adjust those coefficients in just such a way that the energy transfers just the way I want it to. Okay. And this is what I said earlier. Okay. Notice that, again, you can think when you write down the potential at the end of the day, it looks like the potential is the sum of a phi to the fourth term and a phi to the 4 minus epsilon term. The phi to the fourth term is just what you would have if you didn't break the conformal symmetry explicitly. Remember, ADS corresponds to a conformal symmetry. The phi to the fourth is what's there if you don't break it. That epsilon term, that mass term, is explicitly breaking the conformal symmetry. So in the end of the day, we have two sources of breaking. One is the spontaneous breaking that happens in the IR, and the other is the epsilon term, which leaves this 4 minus epsilon and leads for everything to work. Okay? If you just had the phi to the fourth, you just have a runaway. Okay. And this is what I was saying earlier about the response to the perturbation. I could just write down the equations of motion, but I'm going to add a new term, delta t. So when I add the new term, delta t, it's going to change my boundary condition. A is the warp factor, so it's going to change the warp factor. It's going to change the warp factor, which is going to require the phi field, the Goldberger-Wise field, to adjust. In particular, the gradient of the Goldberger-Wise field will have to adjust. The nice thing, though, is that when it does adjust, That's going to lead to delta R, which is what I said earlier, the radian's going to have to adjust. But when I adjust, it's going to adjust in just such a way that if the boundary condition worked in the and at pi, which is the IR, it's also going to work at in the UV. Okay? And that's because there's an e to the 4 minus epsilon there. It adjusts everything just the way I want it to. Okay, so that's just to say my problem is solved, okay? So my problem is solved, this is how it adjusts. And it's not just my problem. I think it also was a problem for anyone trying to write down a 10D version of the theory. Because you write down a 10D version of the theory, but you don't include the field that's acting like a Goldberg or Wise field, you won't get the right answer. Because you will necessarily have something that is sliced inconsistently. You haven't included the back reaction. And it's not a big back reaction. It's completely consistent with the probe approximation the way it's stated. But you have to include that back reaction if you're going to get a consistent gravity, a consistent gravitational solution. Yeah.
So presumably, if the Kaluza-Klein scale at the bottom of the throat compared to the energy density of the cosmological constant is small, this back reaction can be neglected?
Well, what I'm saying is that from a 4D point of view, it absolutely can be neglected. Okay? But if I just want to write down a consistent, higher dimensional version of it, no matter how inconsistent it is, if I have boundary conditions don't match, you're not going to have a consistent solution. And so when you try to write down the 10-dimensional solution, if you don't include this back reaction, you're not going to get the right answer. It's going to look inconsistent.
Well,
okay,
good. Okay? But let me understand when it gives a big correction. So it gives a big correction when the scale of the cosmological constant is comparable to the...
I'm going to get to where it... Okay. It's not just that it gives a big correction. The question is really, when does it destabilize... When can you destabilize the system? And it's going to be surprising. So I'm going to get to that very soon. Okay. So I just want to point out that for those of you who are... The really nice thing about the Goldberger-Wise mechanism is you can also understand it from a dual perspective as sort of a running coupling. and here, because it's sort of a running coupling, you can actually explicitly identify what corresponds to the Goldberger-Wise field in this case. That's the radian I have above, but you can identify the Goldberger-Wise field, and that Hedeker et al. Did that. And so basically it's associated with the coupling. Now it's confusing because it's a Klebanov-Strassler geometry, so it's this funny coupling that's related to the fact that the SUN is actually running, but you can identify a field that kind of corresponds to that running coupling, and that's your Goldberger-Wise field. So that would be the modulus that you'd want to make sure you included. Okay. But what about the radian? The amazing thing that I didn't expect, I thought that it was just going to be left as sort of an open question. It looked like it's stable. It doesn't look like it's non-perturbative. But it turns out that you can explicitly identify the radian in KKLT. And the authors I mentioned previously did it without even realizing it. Okay, so we're going to switch gears for a minute and consider what they called a conifold instability, okay, where S is the conifold deformation parameter. Okay, so the sum omega to the fourth is S, okay, which would be zero if it was just a pure conifold. Okay? And it corresponds to the three sphere at the tip of the cone. Okay?
Square root or fourth root? Is it a square or conifold is usually squared?
I think it...
It should be squared.
It should be squared. I don't know how I got that, because I definitely just cut and paste from somewhere, so I didn't type that myself. But thank you. Okay. All right. So let's look at the potential for S. And some nice work by Douglas and these guys also helped identify this. And it's a really interesting form. Okay, so let's have a look. Okay, so there's a 1 over imaginary rho cubed in front of it. That's just the 1 over sigma cubed. And if you're confused about what this 1 over sigma cubed is, sigma is like r to the fourth. So this is like a 1 over r to the 12th. And that's because we're looking at a cosmological constant. So if you just rescale things, it's going to come with an r1 over r2. So we'll ignore that for now. That's just always going to be there for the ride. Okay, but the rest of it is really interesting, okay? So here there's a term that comes from sort of the superpotential, which has a log S and a constant squared. And then there's this term, okay? Now this term's a little confusing. And I think we're going to be able to pretty much ignore that log term, the first log term there. Because as I'm going to say it later, I actually think that term is secretly like having to do with the volume modulus. And we'll come back to why I think that. So let's just focus on the 1 over s to the 4 thirds term, which is there associated with the warp geometry. Okay, so we now have a potential that has 1 over s to the 4 thirds, log s plus a constant squared. Okay. So So what these guys did is then they added a perturbation. But I'm just going to jump ahead and tell you why I'm excited about this. If you look at this and you squint, you see that this is exactly the form of a radion potential. Okay? Let's take s to the 1/3 to be phi. Okay? Then you see that we have here a phi to the 4th, or minus phi inverse if you like. So it's a phi to the 4th and a log phi and a constant, which is essentially phi to the 4 plus epsilon and phi to the 4th. Okay? So this potential is secretly also a radion potential. And when we minimize it, it's going to be exactly what gives us the length of the throat, which is not surprising because that is what the conifold deformation parameter does. It tells us the length of the throat. Okay? So even though it doesn't look like it, it's going to turn into being a radion in a minute. But in any case, what they notice that you also have the potential from the antebrain. And if you add that, then what you find is something really interesting. Okay? You find that when you minimize this, and you could just write it in this simple form by, so here what I've done is even, so one thing you might have noticed is there's no actual small parameters here. M and K aren't necessarily small. But if I divide through by M over K is supposed to be small because K over M is what's giving us the hierarchy. So K over M is bigger than 1. So M over K is less than 1. So M over K is playing the role of epsilon from before. So it was phi to the 4 minus epsilon, so there's like an epsilon log. Okay? So that's so that M over K is playing the role of epsilon. Okay?
Sorry. I have a question concerning this formula 318. There is an S in the potential for the anti-V3, right? And that S comes, I think, because you replace the warp factor, which is there, through S. Is mm-hmm. that correct?
It's basically the warp factor, yeah.
Yes. And now S is the modulus that governs the size of the three sphere at the mm-hmm. bottom of the shore.
Correct.
So how I understand GKP works, you have switch on a certain flux, K and N. And what you switch on this flux, both the warp factor is determined in terms of the flux, you gave the formula, mm-hmm. and the size of this S is determined in terms of the flux. But now you're treating now S as a dynamical quantity.
Correct.
At fixed flux.
Correct.
But then I think you do not know that the flux will change in this way as you move S. Because you see, you are now asking the question at fixed flux, and if S changes, it's
the flux is determined by the, right, the flux was given you in the UV. You had M and K that were determined in the UV.
It's a whole throat. The flux M.
Well, how the flux changes is definitely, but if you want to use the gravity potential, you have M and K is fixed. That determines this, the whole assumption is that that's determining the running. Now, what you're saying, which I agree with, is that it might be that your supergravity approximation breaks down when you have M small.
So supergravity approximation, it's that you have, I think, no right to replace the x of minus k over m, which was in this formula, by s. You see, in that formula, there was a warp factor, e to the minus k over m, and you replaced it by s, assuming that s is the right dynamical variable that that describes the warping. I'm claiming that to change S, the sphere at the bottom, it is not clear that the warp factor changes. I understand that there's a modulus associated to S, but to me it is not clear that the whole warp factor changes in this
way. I think it is clear because you're, I see what you're saying. You're saying that the e to the minus m over k, because that's discrete and it's not changing.
Couldn't you first ignore the fluxes and consider a conifold with the D3 frame?
In that case, there is simply no potential. S is modulus, and there is no warp factor. And then the whole key is that the warp factor changes. I mean, the claim of the instability arises because in the limit that S goes to zero, the warp factor becomes infinitely large. Mm-hmm. But that's not how the dynamics goes. The dynamics is that the throat is stabilized, at the bottom is the minimal size S3, and S cannot be shrunk further because there's m units of flux sitting on that S3. And the warp factor doesn't go to infinity as S goes to zero.
Sorry, the part about the m units of flux determining it, that's a little bit less clear to me because if you...
I was just wondering, could a rephrasing of what Arthur says not be just that statement that we do not know the off-shell dependence of the warp factor on the S field?
Yeah.
And we only know it very close to the GKS solution. I think that's the problem at heart.
This should be S-VEV. to the fourth earth, if you want. S meaning the supersymmetric
well,
called S.
S is always, I mean, so if I think of it as the radian, it's always like RC. I mean, I'm always essentially putting in the BEV. I mean, that is the field. The field is the BEV of the radian. So, so I don't know the answer, and we can come back to it. But let's just go on and think about whether that's going to solve this.
Can I add on to that one more comment? Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that, and I think there's another way to see the same thing, namely you get this factor that goes to zero from the Keller potential, and I don't think we know the Keller potential works very far away from the supersymmetric minimum. So I mean the superpotential is essentially Veneziano-Yankel superpotential.
Yeah.
Which is not a Wilsonian effective superpotential because that's a whole tower of states.
Yeah.
So now, if you go far away from the supersymmetric minimum, I don't think we know what the Keller potential is.
So you're saying we don't trust that S to the 4/3?
Yeah, the entire P factor is.
Forget the log piece. You're saying we don't trust the S to the 4/3?
Yeah. That's what I would say.
That's probably.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I'm taking this from Douglas, who worked out that it's S to the 4/3 as S goes to zero. Now, it could be that it breaks down, but I think the more interesting point is whether this warping is S or whether it's... And so I don't know the answer to that.
But just to know how sensitive your results are to this, do you need the qualitative feature of the potential?
You know, it definitely depends. It really depends on the fact that it's depending on S to the 4/3. It really depends. And to be honest, the reason I think this has to be the answer is because there really has to be a radian, and so the radian has to act this way. I mean, the radian is determining.
I fully agree with you, but so I think your 5D analysis is completely right. I just doubt that S is the right variable in the proper 10D context.
It might be that it's okay. That's an interesting point. But there is some field that is acting exactly like this.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
Absolutely.
Let's just call it S for now. Okay, let's call it S. But what I would say that, and again, this has to do with the fact that I do think the supergravity could be breaking down, or the simple. Is that I'm going to show that there's this instability for small m. It could be that there is some way of redoing the gauge dynamics, I mean, maybe so that you can actually understand what's going on. What I'm saying is right now, there is no explicit construction that I'm sure works, okay? And I'm still going to stick with that, okay? So let's just, I understand your point. Okay, so just to clarify, this point is that I'm assuming that S to the 1/3 is the warp factor. He's saying that it's e to the minus k over m. I'm saying that I know this warp factor has to be a dynamical field, and it's given that this is what it looked like, I'm going to call it S. But we can come back to whether or not that's right. It's an interesting point. Okay. So then if I write down the potential, I mean, so then if it really is S to the 4/3, and this is really the way it's occurring, then you see that there really is a destabilization. And essentially, it's not like something crazy. It's not something that's really violating anything you would have thought from the probe approximation. It's basically the same. Essentially, what it amounts to is that m has to be bigger than around 2 pi. It's not good enough for m. You might have thought the back reaction is small if there's only one or two, if there's only one antigrade, if m is relatively modest. But m has to be big enough that it has to be basically bigger than 2 pi not to be stabilized by the addition of even a single antigrade. That's what this is saying, okay? Which is... So it's not saying that it's wrong in principle, but it's saying that if I just work out the numbers for this particular model, m root GSM has to be bigger than 7, and being generous and saying GS is order 1, it's saying that m has to be bigger than 7, otherwise it would have to be even bigger.
Just one more comment. It's not so much different. It's a bit stronger, but not so much different from the KPV bound that anyway told us that m has to be significant, right? Remember,
which bound are you talking about?
Just analysis of Kaschuk-Pearson and Verlinden.
Well, but that was just mushy. I mean, there was a bound that said M had to be, I mean, there, you know, you knew that M had to be less than K, but it wasn't really clear what M had to be there.
No, there was a bound in there, P over M less than 0.08.
Yeah,
and if P is the number of anti-D3 range, I think.
Right.
You have to at least have 1, which means N has to be bigger than 12 or something like that. It's roughly the same.
That's for open string instability. That's against the brain force annihilation.
Right, I know. So again, this was the part that it's interesting. I think it's completely coincidental because this is. I'm just assuming that you can get away with having that be stable.
I didn't say it's not the same. It's an argument for a similar bound.
Okay. Okay.
The square of GS is different.
So GS is different. I agree. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So this is just saying what's going on, that this is the potential that I wrote down for the complex structure modulus S. This is without the antibrain. And this is what he was saying earlier, just for those who didn't understand. This is saying that this S minimum is e to the minus k of RAM. So whether you want to take that warp factor...
It's only the minimum, you see. That.
No, I understand. I understand. But... This, okay.
Does this instability arise if I purely in the field theory regime? I mean, in the field theory regime, we don't expect...
Well, okay, so let me just jump to... What I'm saying is that...
By field theory, I mean the Klebanov-Strassler field theory in flat space.
It's hard to know because you have to figure out what corresponds. So you have to break supersymmetry by adding the anti-brain energy, which sure. means that you're adding some. So basically, somewhere in the Kaluza-Klein space, you're basically. So the reason we know it's in the Kaluza-Klein space is we know that somewhere in the field theory there's a supersymmetric minimum. So even though I'm adding this energy, so no one has worked that out. So it might well be that. It's fine in the end if you work it out in the field theory. The only way that's been worked out so far is in the supergravity theory, and the supergravity theory seems to be breaking down. So let me just finish this, and we can. I mean, I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. It's not clear what happens when you add this energy in the field theory. Okay.
But in the field theory, in the decoupling field of Klebanov and Strasser, then S should not be a dynamical field, right? The whole point is that it's a compactification effect, so the finiteness of M plane. That makes S a proper modulus that you need to treat in the 4D supergravity, but otherwise you can sort of gauge it away. Right? I mean,
but there's a field in that regime that is the size of the sphere.
Yeah,
exactly. It's not a field, it's one over G squared.
Well, no. This is the interesting point that Douglas made, that it starts off as a VEV, but then when you use some compensator formalism and include the warp geometry, it actually turns into a dynamical field. You might have thought it was just a VEV, but it's not a VEV. It's actually a dynamical field. And that's what's so interesting about S, the kind of full deformation parameter. Because it started off as a parameter, but it's really a field.
Well, so there's a VEV of gauge, you know, goes like e to the minus 1 over g squared. So g is not dynamical, but the VEV depends on g. That's true. G is a parameter in your theory, right?
Yeah, but it's, well, I mean, if you actually have a dilaton, that it's actually a field. I mean, the question is whether it has a kinetic term.
That's what you say. So that's correct. In the compact model, you cannot think G is a constant. G is a field.
Yeah, okay.
That's what he's trying to say, which is agreeing with what you were saying.
Okay, so you're agreeing. Okay, good. I thought you were saying the opposite.
No,
okay.
You're just confusing the holographic. It's different from the local versus the compact model. It's a very big difference. Oh,
got it. Okay, very good. Okay. All right, so this is what I was saying. That so now I'm just going to rewrite it in terms of what I would have thought was the radian. So S goes like phi cubed. And they actually identified the correct normalization. So they actually identified the phi field in a different context when they were worried about Swalbthun conjectures, which we can talk about. But so phi is proportional to S to the 1/3. And my claim is that it's exactly of the form of a radian potential, which is what I said earlier. So I'm not going to say it again. I do want to point out one thing, and this may or may not be related to what you asked about. Although this is written this way, this is only relevant in a regime where you have large modulus, and it would also make it look like it decouples in the decompactification limit, which is what you were asking about. It's not true. I think it really is just this term, and I think that term is not really part of this potential. And how it works exactly, I don't know, and I'm happy to talk to people about it. But I think it's really a log. Secretly, it's really a log of the volume that's there, because otherwise that term wouldn't be relevant. And also, just to point out another thing, if it is a log of the volume, it's kind of interesting, because what it's doing is, basically, you have this field that's a running coupling. And so remember I said there was no sigma in the exponential when we added that the extra term. There was just a 1 over sigma cubed. And that's because there's this extra piece that would cancel the log sigma. So if you have large volume, the coupling sort of runs to the edge of the space, and then we glue the Klebyow on, and that's basically what that extra field is, and that's why there's this log sigma that's really sitting there.
This is just the period of the non-compact free cycle in the local model, which has to be compacted.
Okay. You can say it that way too, I guess. but it really was...
It's with your interpretation.
Yeah, so exactly. So it was really confusing. Actually, I'll talk to you about it after, I'm curious. But it was really confusing me why that is my sigma. But it really is because the end of the throat is independent of where the Klebyow was. It's just, and yeah, exactly that. Okay. So this is the general form of the potential, and that's what the bound turns out to be. Okay. So it's a real instability. It's saying that you really need largest GSM squared. And again, this is, so now I'm saying that it really is the radian has to have this form. And as, I have to agree, it's a really interesting question how to show that. But I'm pretty sure it has to be true. Now this is what these guys pointed out, which I think is kind of interesting. You could just rewrite K over MGS as KM over M squared GS. But in any given geometry, KM is bounded. Okay? So if M squared GS has to be bigger than 7, and we want to get a reasonable hierarchy, this is going to mean that the net flux in the theory has to be bigger than any Calabi-Yau where everyone has completely stabilized everything. So you need, in order to satisfy the tadpole condition, okay? So to satisfy the tadpole condition, you need a geometry that allows for large KM, and no one has completely worked out an example. Again, it doesn't look like it's necessarily a problem in principle, I mean, but no one has, in fact, has an example where all the moduli have been stabilized, and this is true, okay? There's another problem, which may or may not be a problem. It's something that I actually want to think more about. But it was also pointed out that the cosmological phase transition into RS geometries doesn't necessarily happen by Criminelli, Nicholas, and Rotazzi a while ago. Okay? So what they said, if you have an RS geometry and you take it to high temperature, at high temperature you have ADS Schwarzschild. At low temperature, the IR brain emerges from behind the horizon. But for that phase transition to occur, if M was too large, entropy would disfavor that transition. So they actually had a bound on M. Now, John Mutch Russell and his student also looked at this, but they thought, well, maybe this Klebanov-Strassler geometry is really helpful because you start off with large KM, but then you end up with small M at the end of the day, so maybe it's a little bit better. And it is a little bit better, but they still found an upper bound on M squared of about 21. So it's conceivable that if you have to take M that big, you also would never, if you wanted to really take this theory seriously and think of it as cosmologically evolving, that you would never evolve into the theory you want. Again, I'd say there's many places where I can find loopholes in this, but I find it an interesting observation that M has to be so big that it doesn't satisfy this bound. Okay. So again, if this is true, I'd say the net flux isn't big enough to trust the approximations. And even if you found something where it's satisfied, we still have to address these cosmological issues. I'm not saying that they're insuperable, but they definitely have to be addressed, okay, if M is large. Because how do you transition into this geometry? Okay. So, how much time do I have? I guess I have no time, so I'm just going to take a few minutes just to say some words, and you can ask me about if you want. So forgetting this issue of stability at all, I think there was something very really interesting about this construction. And I think for me, one of the things that was really interesting was how supersymmetry break, and what was confusing too, was how supersymmetry breaking would be communicated. So for example, you know, we said supersymmetry breaking is at the end of this throat, but we also said the energy is going to get transferred over here, which means that you have to actually know about supersymmetry breaking throughout the space. And in fact, at the end of the day, most of the supersymmetry breaking energy better be here to get a consistent geometry, because this is the UV and this is the IR. Okay, so somehow what's going on with the radian is it's not just communicating its transfer of energy; it's also communicating the transfer of supersymmetry breaking in the throat. Okay. Another thing that's really interesting, though, is that supersymmetry breaking is happening here, which is pretty much disconnected from the rest of the geometry. So there is the volume modulus, which could conceivably transfer supersymmetry breaking. But on the whole, you're going to get anomaly mediation. So not only do you have warped geometry, but you get anomaly mediation. So I felt very excited about that. You get both things. In other words, a lot of the rest of the space would know about supersymmetry breaking only through anomaly mediation, through the breaking of scale invariance in the rest of the theory. Okay. And it turns out the volume contribution is actually comparable in size. Because it's suppressed by 1 over A sigma, and A is 1 over N, and sigma is the volume. Okay, so and so it turns out that those contributions are comparable. So when there is a volume modulus contribution, it's comparable. So there's a few things that are interesting here so far. One is that the radian is transferring supersymmetry breaking throughout the throat, even though we thought it was at the end. Another is that there's anomaly mediation. Another is that the volume modulus is contributing in a way that's comparable. But the other thing that's interesting about having a throat where you break supersymmetry is I'm calling it sort of zoned anomaly mediation. So you can imagine having a bunch of throats. And so usually when we have anomaly mediation, the whole point of anomaly mediation is that even if you didn't have direct communication of supersymmetry breaking, just the fact that supersymmetry is broken and scale invariance is broken is enough to tell you that you're going to communicate supersymmetry breaking at the level of beta and 3/2, where beta is the breaking of scale invariance through some running of a coupling, for example. If there's a mass, it's more direct because the scale invariance is coupling directly with M. But if there's just running coupling, you have log lambda, and that's enough to give you some breaking of scale invariance, and that's how anomaly mediation communicates supersymmetry breaking. So usually you think that there's some scale of supersymmetry breaking and everything else is beta M 3/2. The interesting thing is that because of this warping, those relationships can be destroyed. You can actually have additional warp factors. Now the interesting thing also is that if supersymmetry is broken, these threats are happening essentially because there's some global symmetry. If that global symmetry is like a non-abelian symmetry, and it breaks supersymmetry spontaneously, it's only breaking the R-symmetry. So those non-abelian symmetries will remain, and so even though you broke supersymmetry, you can have very controlled communication of supersymmetry breaking. And the naive assumption that if you measure a supersymmetry breaking mass, you know then the ultimate scale of supersymmetry breaking isn't necessarily true, because there can be a warp factor. And that's what basically this slide says. It says these different things, that we have volume modules communicated, anomaly mediated size, there's a radian F term that has the right size to transfer Suzy breaking, and there's zone anomaly mediation because threats survive. And this all says that, and I'm not going to go through it unless there's questions, because we're running out of time. And I'll just conclude. So I think, as we've seen even in this talk, the controversy is actually interesting. So even if I take all the basic assumptions as true, I say that I don't have to worry about whether there are time-independent solutions, I don't have to worry about this non-perturbative thing, there really is this issue of destabilization. I do agree that there might be some question of how to transfer the 10-dimensional theory into the radian theory, but we know that the radian has to be what's controlling that warp. So there has to be this instability, okay? And I think it might even be that the radian is a more robust way of saying it, because I agree with what you said about the conifold deformation parameters. That's actually really interesting. And one thing that we said, though, is that the radian is also, I mean, it's also a savior in the sense that it's essential to the higher dimensional consistency. And I think it does explain, if you look at some of the earlier papers, why when people wrote down 10-dimensional theories with brains and antibrains, they were finding inconsistency. Because unless you put, I mean, there's other reasons, I'm not saying it's all the inconsistencies, because you have to worry about the stringy effects, but just the gravity itself will be inconsistent unless you include this back reaction in the higher dimensional geometry. But having said that, you can see that there is a constraint that M has to be big, and it has to be so big that it's not necessarily a problem in principle, but it has to be big enough that, at least for known collabials, we don't know if it works. So I'd say that the state of the art is that we still don't know whether there is really a completely trustworthy de Sitter solution from string theory, which I find pretty interesting. So, thank you. Yeah, I'd say one of the reasons I came is because I'm really curious what people have to say, so I'd love to talk to you guys.
Let me ask something much more sort of general. So you start with a collabial, and then we're dealing with the radian direction. But I think that what I was hearing is that if you start with the collabial, there's an instability. And the instability will drive the radian direction. Is that what you're thinking about?
So for the collabial itself, the radian isn't a field. I mean, the radian is associated with once I add a bunch of D-brains so that I produce a throat. So if I just had the collabial to start with...
Okay, so maybe the terminology is wrong. I mean, basically a structural modulus is something that's...
So, again...
allow these things to sort
yeah,
of
so the structural modulus is sort of there for the stability, but really the field... That really has a metastable state that is being destabilized is the radian. And this is something that's confusing when you write down even the original Goldberger-Wise. So the Goldberger-Wise potential is a function of the radian. So I can integrate out the heavy field and get a potential purely for the radian. That would be the low energy theory. The radian exists in the four-dimensional theory. So remember I said earlier that you need to worry about the geometry from the higher dimensional point of view, and from the lower dimensional point of view, you have to worry, did you include all the fields? So from the higher dimensional point of view, you would see that the Goldberger-Wise field would no longer transfer the energy enough. From the lower dimensional point of view, you would see that the radian is an unstable field when you write down the potential for the radian.
But the beginning collabial that you are thinking about, mm-hmm. you're saying is unstable. So What is it going towards?
So again, it's the Calabi-Yau. It's not. I wouldn't say it's the Calabi-Yau that's unstable. So I have a Calabi-Yau.
It's the flux configurations, which are stretching out in order to get this zero.
Right, but most of the fluxes associated with Calabi-Yau are associated with Calabi-Yau. What I've done is I've added flux through those cycles that produce this extra throat. Okay. So the instability is purely an instability of the extra throat. So it's.
But what's the stop to do? Which I think you were referring to. What's it to stop it doing hundreds of thousands of throats? You know, in other words, that it's trying to get somewhere which is dynamically different from the initial state.
Right. So what I would say is, okay. So if I think of a conifold, the conifold is getting capped off at a particular distance. What I would say is the state that it's running off to, if my radion interpretation is correct, is just that that conifold wants to just go back to being a conifold with, remember we said that this, the S parameter was sort of the volume of that sphere, it's just going to zero. So it's just going off to infinity. So that if I think of it in a 5D language, if I had, you know, if I have two brains, you know, I have a warp factor that does this. What I'm saying is that this brain is essentially going off to infinity. So that warp factor is going to zero. And that's what that radion going to infinity means.
So complexifying it is just part of the generalized dynamics for the evolution of the extra dimensions is not the way you're thinking about it.
I'm not sure what you're talking about when you say complexifying it.
But putting these extra naturally occurring, I guess, conifolds on it may be just part of the natural dynamical evolution process.
So, okay, so again, the conifold is not essential to the Calabi-Yau. The conifold is an extra bonus thing that's added on to explain the warp factor. If I just was happy to, if I was happy to have ADS space or strongly De Sitter space because I just added an anti-brain right on the Calabi-Yau, I'd be done. The problem is they're trying to balance something that's small against this big whopping anti-brain tension. So that's why they have to do something to suppress energy. So they want to get a warp factor somehow. So it's an additional ingredient. So you didn't need it for the original part. So step one did not require this extra throw. It's only step two that requires it. But
yeah,
once I'm doing
two
step two,
is an unstable direction.
So if I just focus on step two, Calabi-Yau is sort of just going along for the ride. It's just all I'm accounting it as is a boundary condition. So this really complex Calabi-Yau, I'm just saying it's just a boundary condition that tells me what fluxes I started with and what energy I start with, and that's all I'm saying about it. So if we just treat it like that, the instability has nothing to do with Calabi-Yau. The Calabi-Yau is just sitting there. It's really the instability is having to do with what the geometry is doing as I pull off. So again, it's not a pure Calabi-Yau because the Calabi-Yau is a six-dimensional geometry, and one of those dimensions has been stretched out into a throws.
But it is back-reacting. That is an important issue.
The anti-brain at the end of the throat is back-reacting on the throat itself. It's not really changing the Calabi-Yau.
It's also in that pinching region that you've got there.
This region?
Is that a wrong vision? Not down there. I understand down there.
This
right
region?
There. How is that interaction actually?
Okay, good. So it's back reacting in the sense that what's going on here is, remember I said that for the bent brain, it's a matching of the energy on the of the brain versus the bulk energy. Okay. So the bulk energy is not changing. The Calabi-Yau isn't changing. The only thing that's changing is this one modulus field that corresponds to the running coupling, which is getting a slightly different gradient energy here. And then when I do the matching with that different gradient energy, because I changed R, so I change R here, and it just slightly adjusts what this is doing when it matches on. And the energy is just enough that it changes it from being ADS-based to slightly De Sitter.
Yeah, but it's not going to change the fluxes.
But it's not going to change the fluxes. Exactly. Yeah. So it's just a small back reaction of a field itself. Yeah. Yeah.
One more comment regarding this shrinking of the sphere. If you look at the simplest types of sphere compactification of fluxes, point Rubin compactifications,
yes.
Then you always get a potential that looks a bit like a DLT. You have the curvature of the sphere is a potential that wants the thing to collapse. And the flux gives you opposite potentials. So once you drive it bigger, so you get a bigger potential. Particularly if you go to very small volume size of the sphere, you get an ever increasing potential. Never turns down. Mm-hmm. At least not in classical geometry. So that's basically my prime reason why I'm extremely skeptical of this. Is about the turnover to the shrinking sphere in the presence of flux.
Oh.
I just don't think that fluxes would allow that to be.
But it's not the flux that's causing it. It's just really that you've just added this whopping big energy onto it, right?
Yeah, but it's finite. So if you make this thing smaller and smaller, the repulsion of fluxes that wants to keep it at finite size becomes
Well, but bigger. If it just, don't forget though, if I just had the S to the 4/3, if I just had the antibrain, I didn't have the rest of it. Like, suppose that antibrain dominated. That would just make it run off to infinite, right? Because that antibrain, if it really was S to the 4/3 times the tension, that wants to take S to zero.
Yeah,
so that term itself is what's doing it. It's not the fluxes.
But what I said now, the reason to believe that this S to the 4/3 can't really be what's going on.
Well, but that's not true, because you know if it was just a 5D geometry, there would be a radian there.
I think she has every right to call the warping S to the 4/3, just that S is not the size of the sphere.
Right.
It's not the size of the sphere. It's, as you said, some radian. Yeah. But it has to be, I think, correct, carefully check what the actual deformation of the throat is in full 10D.
So it's interesting, because I think, I have secret, okay, so what I think is probably going on is there might be some combination, I mean, no one actually checked that it's arcically orthogonal, and like I said, that kinetic term involves the volume modulus, so it might be that there's some small piece of the volume modulus that enters too. It's not clear that it's completely factorized into those two fields.
I think so.
But it's certainly true that this is the form of, so what is true is that this is the form of a radian potential. It's what it has to be. And so, and I'm almost sure that the original potential is right. So this potential, and so I agree that we have to identify. And this is, to be honest, this is one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk, because it was clear to me that there was some work to be done to really see, because, I mean, beyond seeing that, I mean, it's like a little bit embarrassing, but beyond seeing that it matches the form of the potential I want, and also that it controls the length, I mean, at some level, the size of that sphere does control the length of the throat. The question is really how that size of the sphere is determined by the fluxes in the presence of this extra energy. And I think it might still be S to the 1/3, but I think one has to be more careful about determining how. So in other words, the conifold deformation isn't just determined by the fluxes when I add this extra energy. Mm-hmm. So I think it might well be that when I actually redo it, I do find that it's not just E to the minus M over K, that it really is this S. So it could be the right field. So he had a question and then come back to you. Okay? Because he said his hand up.
Sorry. Yeah, I just have a comment, Lisa. It's not a question. I just want to say that the instability you point out in the radian field is probably much more of a problem for inflationary model building, especially axial monotremy models, because they all rely on brains down warp throats, but they exactly ignore this modulus. And the energy scale in the Suzy braking is the inflationary energy scale, which really would make you tip over much faster.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah. That's really interesting. Okay.
I have not understood your criticism of the largeness of Km. I mean, we agree that Km has to be large, but if there are in principle large tadpoles around, I mean, do you have a reason to mistrust that? I mean, it seems to be.
As I said, I'm just a basic. You know, I'm like a very concrete model builder. You know, when we say we have an existence proof, we just want a model where you've completely worked everything out. I'm just saying that I have no reason to think it's not possible, but I haven't seen a model that has large enough MK where all the moduli have been stabilized, where we know this is
what do you
happens.
Call a model? You mean, I mean, in F theory, there are certainly geometries with very, very large.
And they have lots of moduli. There are, but they have lots of moduli fields. So you have to tell me how I'm going to stabilize all those moduli fields, maybe with the fluxes, before. Yeah, but does anyone know of an explicit example? I don't.
There was actually a conjecture that it cannot be done in Marianas.
I figured I would let you guys say
that.
I mean,
there's a conjecture against calculations, you know, which appear to show that it can be done.
No, there's no calculation. I mean, it's not clear. I mean, anyone who writes down a calculation where you have large MK and stabilize everything, the issue will be settled. It's just, I don't think there is an example yet.
Well, but we know that it is exponentially hard to solve.
I'm not saying it's that hard. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm just saying that as an existence proof, I would just like a model where everything has been worked out, and then I can say, this is a model where I know I can get decisions. And an advantage to that, of course, is that if I have that, not just to say I have an example in string theory, but there's all these problems that arise about understanding de Sitter space. If you actually had a model, you could actually then use it to do things. But until you have an explicit model, it's hard to do that. So I just think there's two reasons you would really like to have an explicit, completely worked out model. I mean, you know, lots of the time, you know, as a model builder, there's lots of times you have a model that essentially works, but you just, you find that, okay, there's some field that's not determined, or there's something, that's not a model. I mean, we really want, I mean, so again, we're not even requiring that the string theory can work out non-perturbatively what happens. You know, these are low energy effects. I'm just giving that. I just want to see a low energy model where everything has been stabilized that I can just say what happens. That's all. I think it's a fair thing to demand. I mean, given that we think there's 10 to the 500 of these, we should at least have one.
There is a reason why you don't have one, because the scenario itself relies on complexity.
Okay, so find one that's
up. So there is a philosophical reason why you're not finding one.
Well, that's fine, but then find another one. I mean, I just want to say, I mean, I'm just saying, like, no one, I mean, this is 17 years. I wasn't paying attention. But 17 years, no one has written down an explicit example.
Why you have
problems? I know why it's hard. I mean, it's hard, and it might be that there, I mean, so there's two possibilities. I mean, one, you know, is that it's just hard and no one's done it. Another, which of course is a lot of what the Swan is, that there's a reason in principle it's impossible. I mean, I'm not buying into either camp. I'm just saying once I have an example, I will believe it's resolved. Without an example, I don't know. That's all. I'm not, you know, again, like I said, I think it's a very clever construction. I think it might work. But I was just interested to see that there is actually an instability in the explicit examples.
I think the claim for the tadpoles is not completely true. I agree with you, it's engineering, it's a complex situation. You have many, many vacuum. It's hard to, like, you know, actively searching, find something. But still, I think for the tadpole question, I think there are vacua which have been, and clavials which have been looked at. The same discussion that I think we had, was it, no, 2 days before, basically, where you basically have a subsector of all the periods of your clavial, which you can write down explicitly through the Picard-Fuchs system, then they depend at higher order on all the others. You can put a finite number of fluxes, and then you find, actually, you get tadpoles up to a few hundreds.
Okay, so but you then you have to stabilize. Strong, but then you, get but then you have to write down every field that you have in that theory and show me that that's stabilized.
No, and that's the whole point. The Picard-Fuchs system guarantees that once you fix the subsector of complex structure moduli with fluxes, all the others will be bounded.
I don't think it's guaranteed. No, you have to work it out.
Guaranteed.
So we have the Republicans on one side, the Democrats on the other. Seeing the same thing and seeing something totally
different. Right. Yeah. It's not guaranteed.
But it's only computationally.
I mean, honestly, if it's
a small CC, here we are asking whether you can get A.
Yeah.
So it's different.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not claiming anything. Like I said, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm not claiming it's possible or impossible. I just wanted to. I thought that this was an example, and I'm saying that this is not an example yet. If you want to turn it into an example, that would be great. And then, I mean, honestly, it would be interesting. It would be interesting to see, like, how many moduli fields you require. Like, what is the minimum MK for which it works? And in addition, don't forget, there is also this cosmological problem, which is something I want to look into further, and other people do. But it looks like if you want to think of it as a cosmological model that starts off at high temperature, I mean, so there's all sorts of issues that people have raised about whether the string theory is stable. What I'm saying is if I just raise this model to high temperature and M is big, it won't fall into the minimum I want. It's going to stay ADS Schwarzschild. It's not going to develop into this kind of structure. So you won't, in other words, it's always going to just have this horizon. So it's never going to have this long warp conifold. So it won't, so you really have these two distinct vacua. One is like a high temperature thing, it's not really vacuum, but you have these two distinct states of the theory. And it's not going to fall into it. So even if you found that, you still have to address this other question. So there are really two points here, I think, once you say that M has to be big. And one is whether it exists at all, and one is if you find it. You might just say, okay, it's only realistic to some extent. It's not a cosmological model. I'll never have it at high temperature. And if you want to say that, that's fine. But I would like to see it as a model that I can actually evolve from high temperature and actually see what it means to have these different minima.
Why does it have to come from high temperature?
It doesn't. I mean, maybe it doesn't. Maybe we just were given, you know, maybe we just started off in ADS space. But there's lots of evidence that we started off at high temperatures, so, you know, it seems that it would be a reason. I mean, it would be nice to understand, in any case, if we had large M, it would be nice to know what the cosmological implications are. If you have to just start off in that right vacuum, that's also pretty confusing. And this leads into things like along the lines of what Sethi would say, but which might be going too far. But, you know, the fact is that the volume modulus field is lighter than the radion field, which means that you're sort of establishing the conical minimum before you have the ADS space, which is actually very confusing cosmologically. So it actually, there's a lot of interesting cosmological issues whether or not you want to say it came from high temperature relief. You know, just how this minimum actually occurs. Again, these things are far apart. The minimum is stable when you have both of them as de Sitter space. If it really just starts off as this other energy, if it starts off as ADS, then it's just going to collapse. I mean, so you really do want to know what's going on cosmologically as well. But that was not the major focus, but I still think it's actually an important question. But, I mean, once you actually show that there is an example, I think there are these interesting cosmological issues also.
Okay, I guess let's thank Lisa again.